Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. A true crime, coming-of-age story with a tragic twist. A New York editor's quest to uncover the truth about the brutal murder of her wild and seductive friend in a riveting and thoughtful examination of how we grow up and apart. As girls growing up in rural New Jersey in the late 1980s, Ashley and Carolyn had everything in common, two outsiders who loved spending afternoons exploring the woods. Only when the girls attended different high schools did they begin to grow apart. While Carolyn struggled to fit in, Ashley quickly became a hot girl, popular, extroverted, and sexually precocious. After high school, Carolyn entered college in New York City, and Ashley ended up in Los Angeles, where she quit school to work as a stripper and an escort, dating actors and older men and experimenting with drugs. The last time Ashley visited New York, Carolyn was shocked by how they had grown apart. 1 year later, Ashley was stabbed to death at age 22 in her Hollywood home. Carolyn would discover she was the victim of serial killer Michael T. Garagiola. Original and engaging, the hot one is the story of Carolyn's emotional quest to find out what really happened to her oldest friend. It's a journey that takes her through the hills of Hollywood, into courtrooms in Los Angeles, to strip clubs in Las Vegas, and back to her own childhood memories as she tries to unravel why she and Ashley became so different. How did Ashley end up the overtly sexual risk taker, the hot one, while Carolyn was seen as the smart one, the observer? Carolyn's memoir will shock and fascinate readers as she explores the power of female friendships and pays tribute to the ones that stay with you long after they're gone. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Hot One, a memoir of friendship, sex, and murder, with my special guest, journalist and author and editor, Carolyn Murnick. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Carolyn Murnick.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much for this interview. Tell us a little bit about your background before we talk about this book, The Hot One, and your personal involvement in this very, very personal memoir, true crime book.
I'm an editor at New York Magazine for the past decade, and before that I had kind of worked my way up the New York City journalism scene as a writer and fact checker at various culture and lifestyle magazines. So I had been kind of in the media world for a while, but I had no professional experience doing anything involving crime or courts or investigation. So by the time I started my book, I was really having to figure it all out as I went along.
Let's talk about, as you write, just introduce in the book that you're 22 years old at this time, but this is in February 2001. Tell us what you find out and how you find out. Tell us more about
sure.
that.
Sure. Well, I grew up in New Jersey, and my first childhood best friend was a girl named Ashley, and she and I were close from the age of 9 years on, and we liked to play piano and go to art classes together, and we lived in a pretty rural area and spent time in the woods. And then her family moved away in the middle of high school, and we lost touch a little bit, but saw each other a few more times between high school and the beginning of college. And then we had what I didn't know would be our last weekend together in New York in the summer of 1999, when she came to visit me at my college apartment. And I go into detail about the sort of reckoning and everything we did together that weekend, and the confusion that I felt about feeling that she and I had very little in common anymore, and I didn't know whether our friendship would be able to endure that. And then about a year and a half later, I learned in our town newspaper in New Jersey that she had been found murdered in her home in Hollywood. And, you know, that she had been, that was sort of a small local newspaper story about a former local resident in this unsolved crime case. And immediately, you know, I was shocked and numb, and I had so many questions about what had happened to her at the end. And I felt like, if and when I ever write a book, you know, I want it to be about learning more about what happened to her, and about kind of honoring the power of childhood friendships for girls especially, and how you really kind of shape your identity around each other, and that this person, everyone sort of has a person that is still a part of their lives, whether or not they are even still in touch with them.
Let's talk about just what you find out from newspaper reports. You write in the book that you don't find out till 5 days later, but this occurs on February 22nd, 2001 in Hollywood Hills. So tell us what you just find out, and then take us back, like you do in the book, to your friendship and how you actually grew up with your childhood friend and the friendship that you developed.
Sure. Well, you know, what I learned in the Bernardsville News, that was our town in New Jersey, you know, was very little. It said that this former PPAC resident, that was the town that she lived in, had been found murdered. And there was some quotes from a family friend saying that she was, you know, very talented, and she had been taking classes at the Fashion Institute. Didn't say anything about suspects. It didn't say, I believe there was some incorrect information about, you know, a boyfriend finding her, when later I would learn that it was her female roommate who found her body much later. And, you know, immediately I was shocked and really confused. And I thought back to the last time I had seen her in the summer of 1999, when she had come to visit me. I knew that she was living in LA at the time, and I assumed that she was also a college student like I was, but through the course of the weekend, she revealed that actually she wasn't spending much time in classes and had a much more party-focused lifestyle in Hollywood. She said that she was working as a stripper occasionally, and sometimes even an escort, and that she was dating older guys that were paying for various things in her life, her Mercedes, and, you know, some of them were actors who were flying her out to meet them on set. And she talked casually about drugs and a lot of stuff that felt so foreign and exotic to me that I didn't even know what to think. And I just, all I knew was that being around her made me feel really insecure myself, because she appeared to have so much confidence and to be enjoying life so much when I was an insecure 20-year-old, and I was sort of just figuring out dating and trying to make my way in the world. Ashley seemed like she had it figured out and was having a lot of fun doing it. And of course, you know, she wasn't like that as a 9-year-old. I mean, the core of the book is really about how the two of us started out so similarly. You know, we were both in childhood bonded over pretty sort of innocent and creative hobbies and activities. We both came from loving homes, and it seemed like, you know, we had everything in common and we're going on parallel tracks. But then at the time of her death, we were living very, very different lives. And so this book is also tracing how she got to, you know, from where we started to where she ended up. And then the book also takes on my journey to find out answers about what happened to her over the next, you know, I spent close to 15 years on this. Well, she was, I won't give away too much, but I started working on the book 7 years after her murder, when I learned that a man had been arrested in connection to her death, and as well as 3 other victims.
As you write in the book, but this, as you've just explained, is more so, especially because this is loaded with celebrity, You can name drop all kinds of people in this, and also this serial killer that I mangled his last name. So you can tell us Michael's name. And you say 7 years afterwards, when you become involved in this, you find out details about this killer. Tell us what you find out at that time, and tell us how you start to take on this investigation and also this exploration.
Throughout my 20s, you know, she was killed in 2001. I was 21 at the time, and she was 22. You know, her family had moved back to California, and we weren't able to connect with, you know, finding out any new information. So to the best of my knowledge, I thought that it was still an unsolved case. I did not have context to be able to learn more from law enforcement about even if there were active investigations going on. And so 7 years went by exactly like that. And it wasn't until the fall of 2008, you know, I had been Googling her every few months and not really coming up with much. And finally, in the fall of 2008, I had just gotten a new job that gave me access to the LexisNexis database. So I decided to Google her again, look her up there. And I learned and I discovered that big news had happened. A man had been arrested and for an attempted murder in the Los Angeles area. The woman survived, and now he was in jail waiting trial, and he had been connected to two other unsolved murders in Los Angeles going back to Ashley, and then there was someone else in 2005, and he was also a person of interest in an unsolved murder of his high school classmate in Illinois. He's from suburban Chicago. And so all at once I was like, you know, I was shocked. I had no idea that, you know, is this a alleged serial killer? Who is this person? How is he connected to her life? And it wasn't until 2 years later when I was able to attend the preliminary hearing for this guy that I learned much more about who he actually was and how he had infiltrated his way into her life, you know. But I also want to say, not to give away, you know, not to give away the book, but the case has still not gone to trial yet as of April 2019. So this guy has been in jail waiting trial for 11 years. We can't call him, you know, convicted yet.
Right. What did you find out about how your friend Ashley came in contact with this killer?
Well, I learned that in the preliminary hearing, you know, I had listening to her friends testify, and talking to them outside of the courtroom, I learned that this guy was someone who lived down the street from them in Hollywood. And he one day just appeared on the road when her friend's car had a flat tire, and he said that he would help them fix it. And he also said he was an air conditioning repairman, and he gave them his card. And so then a couple days after that, they realized that their boiler had broke, and so they decided to call him, and he came over. And then from then on, he would stop by unannounced and, you know, was trying to ingratiate themselves into their social circle, because they were, you know, this house in this cul-de-sac in Hollywood was, you know, an active social center that people would stop by. They would have parties. And so it wasn't completely unusual that this new person was stopping by unannounced, but a few of her friends testified that they always felt he was creepy and they didn't like having him around, but Ashley felt that he was harmless and it was no big deal. And at the time, he was also only a few years older than she was. So he was in his mid-20s. I think he was 26 at the time of her murder and she was 22. One more thing I was just going to say. He was also relatively good looking. He had told people that he came to Hollywood to try to make it as a boxer or an actor, and he had been in a student film. And so, you know, the other thing about him is he didn't necessarily stand out in her crowd of kind of good-looking young people. He fit in as someone that, you know, seemed like he could belong, more or less.
You write in the book about that last meeting that you have that is unnerving. And part of this focus of this book and what you call the book The Hot One, tell us a little bit about that visit with her and what is the events that demonstrate to you some of the things that that you hadn't seen before in terms of attention from men and sort of that the difference between you, the stark difference between you that was demonstrated in that last meeting that you had with her.
Yeah. Well, you know, a big theme of this book is how, for girls, you are really figuring out your place in the world and your identity in reference to one another. And you might look at a friend and be like, she is, you know, she seems to be confident about talking to guys on the street, or, you know, she's trying that drug. Maybe I should try that drug. You're looking at your friends and they cause you to question your own decisions and sometimes kind of show you who you want to be or brings up issues of jealousy. And, you know, that was a lot of what I was going through in that last weekend with Ashley. You know, it started out that when I met her coming off the, I believe she took the bus into New York City, she just looked like a totally different person. She had, you know, bleached blonde hair, and she was wearing a, you know, as I remember it, just very different L.A. sort of clothes. And I'm sure anyone who's been to L.A. knows that in L.A., everyone's beautiful, and they wear fewer clothes than they do in New York, and they wear more body-conscious clothes, and there's more of a sort of sexualized aesthetic out there. And that was not something I'd seen before at the time. I mean, this was before, now everyone wears leggings everywhere. Back then, seeing someone wearing leggings as pants in the year 1999 was a little bit shocking. Right. And that was the kind of stuff that Ashley wore. She had leggings as pants. She had see-through t-shirts. She was wearing, you know, glitter eye makeup, and she had, you know, her hair was a different color. And I struggled to recognize her in a way when I first saw her. I was like, I struggled to connect her to the girl that I had known. And, you know, as we proceeded to spend the weekend together and doing things like, you know, going out to a club and, you know, meeting the guy that I was dating at the time, and I just saw how much more confident she was and how much more sexually forward she was than I was. And you know, going to a bar with her, how men were magnetized to her energy. I had never seen anything like it. It at once made me feel, you know, distant from her, and it also made me feel bad about myself. And, you know, after she left that weekend, I remember thinking, I don't know if I can handle that again. Maybe, you know, maybe Ashley and I will reconnect, you know, later on in life, but I'm not sure that this is going to work anymore.
In this investigation that you undertake to find out what really happened with your friend Ashley, you meet her friends that end up testifying at the preliminary that you go to, and you meet other players like Detective Small and other people and journalists and other people that help you with everything that you're trying to investigate and trying to do with this book and trying to find out more about your friend. Tell us a little bit about your experiences with some of Ashley's friends and sort of the picture that they paint or they have for you as to the character that she develops into in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I mean, it was a very fascinating thing because if you can put yourself back in the stage of life as of being like 20, 21, it's a big time of transition. It's a time when you're meeting a lot of new people and, you know, you're figuring out if your relationships from high school or earlier are still serving you. And so the friends who I met, who I'd go on to meet in the preliminary hearing, who will be testifying in the trial, most of them were people who had only known her for about a year. And you know, it was fascinating to me that they knew her in a totally different way than I did. They knew her as someone that, you know, would go to movie premieres and hotels with them and would do drugs and was very glamorous. And one friend was her friend Chris was a fashion stylist at the time, and he told me that he would sometimes borrow clothes that he had been working with on shoots, and that Ashley would put on these amazing designer gowns, and they would go out to fancy hotels and have drinks, and everyone would be staring at her. And, you know, so that was fascinating for me to hear, because it was, you know, totally different. They knew her in a totally different way than I did. But, you know, ultimately, some of these people, Chris in particular, is someone that I've developed my own friendship with over the years. And I also recognize that this group of friends, as we all did, experienced a great trauma with this murder. And it sort of, I came to understand, broke everything apart for this kind of carefree group and the way that they had been living. Basically, after the murder happened, her roommate never again went back to that home, and they really hadn't seen each other in many, many years, because I think what happened with them is in the months following the murder, you know, they were all being contacted by police a lot and trying to piece things together. And then as the investigation either stalled or went in a different direction, they stopped hearing from people and even stopped seeing each other. And I think that, you know, I'm imagining that it felt like reconnecting was very painful. And so when I was meeting them all at the preliminary hearing 9 years after the murder, it was clear that that was the first time in a long time that any of them were seeing each other again. And so, you know, it's a real comment on how a loss like this and a trauma, it has such a long reverberation in people's lives. And those friends and, you know, me as well, we'll always sort of be connected in a very somber and painful way by having this loss of this shared person. But we may not, you know, we may not actually be talking every day, or it may be painful to see each other.
You write about the undue, I guess, focus on this story because of actor Ashton Kutcher's involvement. Tell us just a little bit about the preliminary that people speculated that he might be appearing at that preliminary. Tell us his minor involvement in this story.
Right. So one of the reasons this case has gotten a lot of media attention is that on the night of her murder, Ashley was supposed to be going on a date with the actor Ashton Kutcher. And at that time, he was young and sort of just starting to break out. He had been on the second season of That 70s Show. And, you know, he was someone that they knew in their world of, you know, going to Chateau Marmont and other sort of Hollywood places where actors hung out. And what I understood was that he had been to a couple of parties at their house before, and that this night that Ashley was killed was the Grammy Awards, and they had made plans to hang out on their own for the first time, and he was going to pick her up and take her to some Grammy Awards after party. And
right.
He, you know, so his involvement in that night, you know, would have been minor, except that it turns out that he's an important figure in establishing the timeline of what happened that night, because they had talked on the phone a few times, I think at around 9 p.m. or 8 p.m., and then he arrived at her house around 10 p.m., he saw the lights were on, he knocked on the door. She didn't answer. He called her again, I think, and she didn't answer. And then he looked around the side of the house and saw what he later told police he thought was spilled red wine on the carpet. And then he left. And so it wasn't until the next morning that her body was found by her roommate, who also, in a twist, was not able to stay at home that night, because she also arrived at their house earlier in the night and realized that she had forgotten her keys. So she went to her boyfriend's house that night, which is why Ashley was alone in the house. So as Ashton started to get more famous in the mid-2000s after he married Demi Moore, you know, all sorts of tabloid magazines were doing splashy stories about him, and this his connection to this crime came up again, and he a big feature in In Touch magazine dug it up and sort of focused everything on him, that like Ashton had this tragedy from his past, Ashton's connection to this unsolved Hollywood murder. And after that, you know, the story has international attention now. You can Google her name and see stories in all sorts of languages about Ashton Kutcher's tragedy. And that's something that I grapple with in the book, in the way that so far too often stories of female victims come about the men and their life, and what happened to them is eclipsed by either, you know, people being fascinated with the male killer or people being drawn to either the men orbiting around the women. So what I really wanted my book to do was kind of push back at that way that often formulaic crime storytelling can too often eclipse the female victim's life entirely.
In this preliminary as well, you find out more about the crimes of Michael Gargiulo. But at the same time, not only that, you write in the book that you are hesitant to find out everything there is to find out in terms of the details. Tell us why you are hesitant to find out all of the details of your friend Ashley's demise, but also what you find out about this killer and other crimes that he's suspected for and charged for.
Well, you know, I think as anyone knows who gets immersed in crime stories and trying to learn more about an unsolved case, there's always going to be new things to learn. You're never going to get to the end of all the data and all the people that could be interviewed and, you know, all the details of, you know, the pattern of violence that he inflicted on women. And as I sat through the preliminary hearing, I learned a lot more details of, you know, and then I would go on to request reports and read about, you know, how many stab wounds each victim received and, you know, very, very, horrific elements of trauma that were described in some of these expert reports. And ultimately I found myself, you know, in the beginning I felt a duty to sort of bear witness to this trauma that Ashley had endured. And I, you know, I read her autopsy report very seriously, and I thought, and I looked at, you know, what was written about the condition of her organs at her time of death and the, you know, the position of the wounds and, you know, the speculation about the murder weapon and the murder, you know, scene and the motive and all of that. But finally, you know, as years went on, I realized I'm not sure this is helping me or helping anyone anymore. And in fact, like, there's always going to be more to learn. And so, those things are not helping me achieve closure. I'm not actually sure that closure is ever really possible with something like this. And so after a time, I had to start practicing how to let go and recognize that, you know, there will always be more things to learn and more reports and more gory details to uncover. But I don't actually think that will ever make anything okay. And it is not, is not what I need in my life.
How did you approach this then? If you say that there were certain things that you didn't want to focus on, what did you focus on in this, and why did you hang in there? You talk about deciding to leave, not wanting to. You talk later about reading the report from O'Toole, all the 76 pages. Tell us who you go to for comfort and who helps you through this in this process.
You know, this was a book, and this was a project that I worked on for, you know, about 8 years, and so a lot of things happened in my life along the way, and through it all, I was just sort of pushed along by this sense that this was an important story that needed to be told. And, you know, it wasn't just the story of her death. It was the story of the power of female friendship. And that as when I would talk about Ashley and my relationship to her with other people, I started to recognize that people would tell me their own stories of their lost friends, whether or not someone knew someone who had been murdered. Everyone had a friend who got away, and that felt like a universal experience that was painful or that was complex for people. And then women in particular also had they had their own stories about, you know, a certain friend that either was sexually more advanced than they were, or someone that got pregnant earlier in their lives, and, you know, how they think about what happened to that person versus where they are now, and how you really carry with you that sense of self-comparison. So I knew that those ideas were big ones and important ones that I felt I owed it to myself and to Ashley to put that out there and tell that story. However, originally I had set out to do a completely different book. When I thought, you know, the preliminary hearing was in 2010, I thought that the trial is usually 1 to 2 years after that. And I thought that I would be attending the trial and structuring the book around that, and I would have something very different and much more closed instead of the open-ended book that it became, because due to so many judicial and administrative, tangles, this case has still not gone to trial, which is, you know, very, very unprecedented, the fact that this guy's been awaiting trial 11 years. And so that really changed the scope of what I did. And so along the way, you know, there were many people I talked about who I was looking for guidance around, like, how can I shape this story? What am I after that has a beginning, middle, and end, without the trial? And I found guidance from all over. Sometimes that was journalists that I worked with at New York Magazine, who I really respected. And, you know, I also connected with journalists from the LA crime reporting world who had been covering this case for a while. One of them, Christine Pelisek, I'm not sure if you're familiar with her yes. work, but she would be yes. a great person to have on the show as well. She yeah. has written a book about the Grim Sleeper serial killer in LA, but at the time when I met her, she was covering the Gargiulo preliminary hearing for LA Weekly. And she and I have stayed in touch, and she's been a professional resource for me. And she was also someone that I learned a lot from, just observing how she conducted herself in court and what it looked like to be, you know, dedicated to a story, but not be personally involved in the same way that I was. And I took lessons from just watching that.
Mm-hmm. You write that part of the reason for this extraordinary delay is that something that is unusual, or is this pro per? What was the decision by the judge, and first by the killer, terms of this pro per? Explain that, please.
Yeah. So part of what's taken so long is that since this is California, the prosecutor is calling for the death penalty. There's all sorts of systems in place that in situations like this, they need to be very, very careful that everything is done by the book for in the lead up to the trial and during the trial, so that the verdict won't be overturned in appeal.
Right.
And so they have to really make sure that there's no appearances of the defense ever being rushed or the defense not having the resources that they need, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's part of the reason why a case like this can really stretch out, because the judge has a really hard, is trying to avoid having to having to say, it's time we get, you know, you've taken too long, it's time we get to the trial, because then later, potentially, the defense can use that for overturning the verdict. So in this case, right, the defendant has court-appointed attorneys, and he's been allowed to, you know, work with one for a year, and then they have a personality conflict, and he gets rid of them. And another one is appointed who he works with for 2 years, and then that person gets fired. And so he's been allowed to have this counsel change over and over again. And in the middle of all of that, he also decided he wanted to represent himself. And so he had, I think, a court-appointed attorney sort of assisting him, but he was attempting to speak for himself in hearings, and he wasted about 2 years' time with that plea. However, you know, I've heard different things that perhaps he was never actually interested in. He was never actually interested in representing himself in trial. He just wanted to, you know, continue to waste people's time, and he is excited by being able to be the puppet master of these proceedings, even from behind bars. And that perhaps when you have this pro per, pro se, you know, status, you get extra privileges in jail that perhaps he wanted for other reasons, which is, I think, having to do, you know, having to do with phone and computer usage. But he was never actually interested in representing himself at trial. So that wasted a couple of years. Then he got another attorney on top after that who lasted a couple of years. There was an issue with him. Now he's finally with someone that seems like things are, you know, moving along, and the case is finally in jury selection. So it should be going to trial this, you know, the next couple of months.
We haven't told the audience exactly all these charges. Maybe we didn't get into any detail, mm-hmm. but you talked about finding out the details of Maria Bruno, 34, mm-hmm. mother of four from El Salvador, who lived in an L.A. suburb of El Monte. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the victims. Just, we won't get into the details, but just the victims that he was charged for and awaiting.
Sure. Well, you know, things have changed even since his initial charge in 2008. At that point, I think he was charged with maybe 7 felony accounts, and that covered 3 victims. So there was Ashley in 2001, right, Maria Bruno in 2005, who was, as you said, a mother who lived in a housing complex that I think he was also living in or living near. And then in 2008, he broke into a woman's home and repeatedly stabbed her while she was sleeping, and she managed to kick him off of her, and he ran away. And that was the one who he was finally picked up for, because he left DNA evidence at the scene. And so that victim, you know, that victim has survived. And so there was those three, you know, so 2 murders and 1 attempted murder in 2008 in Santa Monica. And then he's also connected to the murder of his high school classmate, Trisha Picaccio, in Glenview, Illinois, and that was from 1993. And he was always a person of interest in that case, but they were never able to charge anyone because of, you know, all sorts of issues, and, you know, perhaps plays into also things happening in Cook County and political stuff that I can't even really speak about. But after he was put in jail in California awaiting trial, you know, California and Illinois law enforcement were able to connect, and there was also a CBS 48 Hours episode about this unsolved Illinois case that aired, I believe, in 2012 or 2011. And after that show came on, a new witness came forward who said he knew Gargiulo in Hollywood, and he had confessed in passing to killing someone, his high school girlfriend in Illinois, a long time ago. So that new witness was enough to finally charge him for Trisha Picaccio from 1993. However, you know, it's really up in the air if that case will ever get to trial either, because that's not going to even get started until
the whole California situation ends. But he's now, you know, formally charged with 4 victims.
You included a haunting story, an account from Tricia Procaccio's parent, father, Rick. As you write in the book, tell us about this bizarre event.
Yeah. You know, from what I learned about that case in Glenview, and, you know, the other commonality between Gargiulo and all his alleged victims is that he lived very close to all of them, and they were, you know, most of them were people that he knew socially prior to the murder. So Tricia was a, you know, talented, beautiful, college-bound girl, and everyone had, this was the summer before everyone was about to leave for college, and on the night of her murder, the kids had organized some sort of scavenger hunt throughout the neighborhood, and people were driving around to different locations, and Tricia got dropped off at her house at, you know, close to, I think, very late at night when it was dark out, and she also lived on a cul-de-sac, and Gargiulo lived a couple streets away. And then the next morning, her father came out to walk the dog and found his daughter's body on the steps and, you know, found the most traumatic sight ever. And her parents, you know, continue to, I think, be incredibly, it just kind of, her parents are still stuck in the trauma of that day, and they still live in that house, and they're still, you know, every day committed to fighting for justice for her. And what I've read from other accounts, in the years after Tricia's murder, Michael still lived down the street, and it was reported that there was one instance when, you know, he kept stopping by the Picaccio's house, and, you know, he used to be family friends with the parents and was friends with Tricia's older brother, and so he kept stopping by, and it was as if, you know, he somehow felt like he wanted to be around. And at one point, I read in a story that there was a night when Tricia's father wasn't home, but the mother was there, and Michael came in and looked really, you know, really distressed, and, you know, said he had something to say, and, you know, was really agitated, and the mother was like, okay, sit down. And, you know, then before he could speak, his brothers like burst in the door and pulled him away. And then just a few months later, he left town. And then that was when he started making his way to Los Angeles. And a couple shortly after that is when he would connect with Ashley's crowd.
Right. In this book, you write about your attempt, your contact with Gargiulo. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, for a time I thought maybe he would be someone that I would want to interview. And I did write to him once and, you know, kept a P.O. box down the street for the return address for a letter if he chose to write back to me, but we never got anywhere with that. And ultimately I was grateful for that because I'm not sure what I was prepared to do. I think I just felt like, you know, maybe I was influenced by all the crime storytelling I had read in the past, as if somehow speaking to the killer was like the holy grail of contact or information that you could get. But as time went on, I realized not only did I not actually want to speak to him, you know, I didn't believe that he was holding all the answers or holding any answers, and that my book really wasn't about him, and I didn't need to give him any more attention.
Mm-hmm. Now, you write about this trial still up in the air. He's delayed this. It has been delayed. And obviously, as you mentioned, that the goal or the objective or the book has changed in terms of its focus.
Yeah.
And your idea of closure, again, it's overly used, this closure, the idea of closure. But again, when you written this, The Hot One, what did you find? Where did you two people, you two friends that had so much in common in this exploration, what was at least a partial conclusion as to what happened to create this difference?
I think it's very complicated, and I think that unfortunately, you know, at 22, when Ashley was killed, you're really just starting out your life, and you have no idea what you're going to become. And it's, I think it's a time of experimentation for most people. And so the real tragedy to me is we never got to find out, and she never got to find out what she would do with her life. But, you know, what I did reflect on, and I still think about a lot, is just how powerful the male gaze is in a girl's life. And growing up, you may not even know what it is, but you recognize that things are different for girls versus boys, and you're going to be, the assumptions are going to be made about you based on how you dress and how, you know, how friendly you seem, and that comes with dangers. And these are things that girls in their teenage years are starting to figure out and try to gather information about. What is the world of men and sex, and how safe do I feel, and how comfortable am I, you know, how comfortable am I experimenting with new ways of being and ways of, you know, asserting that or owning that power? And the fact is, as a 22-year-old, as a 21-year-old, none of us really understands what that's actually about, but we do, you know, you still feel the power of male objectification. And when you're a young woman, it can feel, I think, intoxicating. It can feel like, you know, perhaps this is what I have to offer right now. And so what I think the biggest things that affected Ashley and me, you know, being in different places in that point, is our different attitudes around kind of embodying our sexuality and our comfort level with kind of exploring that world. And I think that, you know, perhaps many years later, when I was in my 30s even, and when I was at a different stage with dating and my relationships, I think I even started to understand, I started to understand more the place that Ashley might have been in her 20s, that, you know, as much as she was someone that attracted a lot of attention, was getting asked out on dates, having older guys wanting to buy things from her, that didn't actually mean that she was having positive and meaningful relationships with men. And I think ultimately that's what we all want. And this is a long-winded answer to say, I think it all comes back to objectification of girls and women, and how different girls are, you know, navigating those complicated dynamics of the world.
Speaking about objectification, it's very, some striking visual images arise from reading this book. And you go to the strip club where you find out that she would go weekends and go to Vegas and work on the weekends there to make even more cash than she'd been making dancing in the club that she normally worked in. And you talk about, in your journey, you actually want to go on the pathway that this killer would have seen. I talk about objectification in the clubs, but you went to the pathway to see what? What did you find on the actual pathway in terms of what he could see, what he desired, and what that attention had drawn?
Right. I mean, I had, you know, close to the end of the book, when I'm, you know, recognizing that this is a story that will always consume me, and that there's no clear ending, and it's like getting time for me to let go. I had learned, you know, and I had been advised by one of the prosecutors that that the you know, what I spoke about in the beginning of Gargiulo just appearing on the street when Ashley's friend had a flat tire. I'm not sure it'll ever be provable, but, you know, it's been suggested that all of that was sort of orchestrated, that he had potentially been studying her and, you know, stalking her from afar for weeks and maybe months, and that's maybe his pattern of surveillance on all his victims, that he had already, you know, he had been plotting and calculating and orchestrating the scene of the murder for a long time, down to, you know, knowing her comings and goings from her house and who she spent time with, and knowing, you know, the time of day that she gets up and goes to bed, and who is coming in the house of this house and why. And one of the ways that he managed to pass while doing this sort of covert surveillance was that he had a dog. And I've been told that, you know, that's an easy cover for someone that's trying to pass, that actually he has a reason to be out in the neighborhood walking a dog. But what he's really doing during that time is, you know, studying his targets and their environment. And Ashley's house happened to be across the street from a dog park. And, you know, I had been told that, you know, that was the place where he was coming, perhaps had been coming routinely to look into her house and study the rhythms of it with his dog.
Yeah. You write also that in this investigation, and as I call it, exploration, you found out some alarming things from, I mentioned, a woman named O'Toole and her report, her 76-page
uh-huh.
report. And you, something that, again, the big true crime fan might know about, but tell us about what you found out about Picarism and its relation to this case.
Oh, right. I mean, this is getting into the really gory, sensational stuff about the book that I would almost like to leave for the reader to uncover. However, I'll just say
Absolutely.
That one aspect of the book is me going through and processing a report done by this former retired serial killer profile expert, Mary Ellen O'Toole, who your listeners might be familiar with. She appears on a lot of shows, and she had conducted a years-long examination of all the crime scenes associated with Gargiulo. So that was the four different victims in Illinois and the three different areas of LA. And she had identified multiple points of commonality amongst all of them. And they were things that were common to, you know, all the victims shared they all happened to live near Gargiulo at the time, things like that. And it was also commonalities around his manner of inflicting violence and, you know, what his methods might have been. And that was some of the most disturbing stuff, and disturbing, upsetting, and kind of really just kind of shattering material to read about someone you had known. And you know, many readers have really responded to that part as quite an impact, because I talk about that arrives pretty much in the last quarter of the book. And so at that time, the reader has learned a lot about Ashley and learned a lot about, you know, the journey that I've been on over the years. And, you know, some might suggest that including that kind of graphic detail is potentially exploitative, but I really wanted it to I wanted it to make an impact around, by the time you've gotten to this place in the book, you know this victim in a personal way, and reading about her in this depersonalized way now is jarring and should not be taken lightly. And to me, it was, you know, one of the most powerful ways of just really hitting home the significance and the trauma of what crime storytelling, what crime is about. You know, this was a real person's life that absolutely who has had inhumane and, you know, outrageous things done to her.
Absolutely. Now, you talk about this exploitation, but I got to say that in this book, you go to extreme levels to leave this to the very end for any kind of detail. The lack of sensationalism with this, given the opportunities that you had to do that, I got to commend you for, I got to say, this is a total lack of exploiting on the things that you very much could with this. And the focus is the relationship that you had with your friend. And really, it really did confound you that she could end up in the place that she did in comparison to your life and the differences that happened after she moved to California.
I hope that readers definitely feel that sensitivity, because I know that this is a case that has been treated all sorts of ways in the media, whether it's, you know, telling the story through the lens of her killer or through Ashton Kutcher, or just, you know, describing her as a Hollywood party girl who worked in the sex industry. And to me, she was always, she's a complex person who has a history and has, you know, deep relationships and people that remember her. And she is the victim of a heinous violent crime. And I wanted to lay out all of that for the reader. And, you know, there's no easy way to make sense of all that, because it doesn't make sense. And I hope that, you know, at the end of the book, the readers really kind of understand the complexity of these questions and this loss.
I think you really do explore the idea that she was much too young for anyone in any context to be able to make an evaluation or an assessment of her life. To sum it up, as like you say, the couple times you heard and very annoyed you to be depicted as a party girl, again, 21, 22, you describe the almost magnetism that this girl has at that young age. She's just a beautiful, nice, you know, a friend to people. She's a beautiful person. A beautiful person. So she succumbed. She really, truly was a victim. And that you said that she didn't have the opportunity like yourself. You write that you were pregnant with your daughter, and the life that you had, you wouldn't, you know, trade for anything. You had difficulties. But in this book, you write about really her personality. Very much in most books, you don't get that. You get a brief summary about how she lit up the room and how she was a great girl. And you've done an admirable job of going and exploring who she became and why. And unfortunately, you're there to bear witness at this preliminary, and you plan to be at the trial to bear witness to your friend's murder and to see justice done. However, as you write, closure is something that's just a maybe overused cliche.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that sensitive take on the book. I'm so glad you found it, and I look forward to hearing what your listeners think of it.
Yes, absolutely. For those that do you have a Facebook page or a website for people that might want to find out more information about this and this book?
Sure. You can find me on Twitter at Carolyn Murnick, and my website is carolynmurnick.com. I'm also on Instagram at cmurnick, and I have been writing for The Cut at New York Magazine on some of the recent things happening with the trial, and that's probably where I'll place some essays when I'm out covering the trial. So check out The Cut at New York Magazine and also my website, carolynmurnick.com, for the latest.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for talking about The Hot One, a memoir of friendship, sex, and murder. Thank you very much, Carolyn Murnick. You have a great evening. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.